He heard the Lord say that day, "It's time to go home." He was, I suppose, to a certain degree ready because, well, it was his birthday. It was his 120th birthday, as a matter of fact. And even though he was 120 that day, the Bible says that his eyes weren't dim. That is, he didn't even need reading glasses. And his strength wasn't abated. That is, he was a strong, virile man. Even though he was 120, he was as strong as he was decades earlier. Incredible. But on his birthday, there in Deuteronomy, we hear the story of how God would say to that man, Moses, "It's time for you to go home." And then the Lord began to share with Moses, "But when I take you to heaven, here's what's going to happen to the congregation that you've been ministering to, that you've been sharing with, that you've been providing leadership for. When you go, Moses, they're going to turn their back on me. They're going to rebel against me. They're going to get involved in pagan practices and in idolatry." Now, Moses, no doubt, would have felt, "Lord, why are you telling me this? It's my birthday. I'm 120. And you tell me that I'm about to move on up into heaven? And there's going to be this kind of rebellion when I go? Why are you telling me this, Lord? Are you trying to spoil my birthday party?" Speaking of spoiling birthday parties, this was in the news, Reuters News Service, earlier in the week. It's from London. Briton Bob Talley reached his 100th birthday, read a congratulatory telegram from Queen Elizabeth, uttered a proud, "Yes, I made it," and promptly died. But his sudden departure did little to dampen the celebration, for family, friends, and the staff at his nursing home in southeast London went ahead with the party anyway as he lay in his bed dead. It was a bit of a shock when we were told that Uncle Bob had died on the morning of his 100th birthday, Talley's niece Barbara Barwell told the Daily Telegraph. But everyone was turning up to the party, so it was great. Everybody was dancing with each other and reading his cards while he just lied there, Barwell said. He knew that he had reached 100, and I think he relaxed and just let go. Buckingham Palace was quoted as saying it was glad that Talley had received the Queen's telegram. Quote, "Of course it is very sad to learn that he died so shortly afterwards," end quote, a palace official said. So a couple of days ago, Bob Talley, on his 100th birthday, reading the Queen's telegram, "Congratulations. Yes, I made it." That's the last thing he would say. And he died, and the party went on without him. Moses was told, "Hey, I know it's your birthday, but Moses, it's not time to party. Not really. Because you see, when you go, the people are going to turn against me." Now, why did the Lord let Moses know that? Because there was still something for Moses to do in light of that fact. See, I don't care how old you might be, whether you're 20 or 80 or 120, until the day that the Lord takes you and takes me home, there's something more for us to do, something left for us to do. And when we're through, that'll be the day when he takes us home. But until that time, there's always something he has for me. There's always something he wants from you. And with Moses too. "Moses, I know it's your birthday. I know you're 120. But here's what's going to happen. And in light of that, I have a task for you to take on. I have a job for you to do." And that task and job is found in Deuteronomy chapter 31. Would you turn there with me for our reading today? In Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 16, 17, and 18, the Lord is telling Moses, even as I shared, that the people are going to be rebellious when he's no longer there. They're going to turn their back on God. They're going to turn to, verse 18, last phrase tells us, turn to other gods or idols. In light of that fact, here's what God says that Moses ought to do. Verse 19. Now, therefore, write ye this song for you, and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. And it shall come to pass, verse 21, when many evils and troubles are befallen them, that this song shall testify against them as a witness. For it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their seed or children. For I know their imagination which they go about even now before I have brought them into the land that I promised. So, verse 22, Moses therefore wrote this song that same day and taught it to the children of Israel. The Lord says, Moses, the people are going to be rebellious, so here's what I want you to do. I want you to write a song and teach it to the congregation that when they go through evil days, when they go through deep waters, when they go through tough times, as a result of their rebellion, that they will remember this song, Moses, and it will be a witness for them. It'll remind them of the warnings that I gave to them. It will remind them about the plan and the love that I have for them. Write this song and teach it to them. It's as though the Lord knows that, well, people, congregations, me and you, we don't remember preaching sermons or lectures or teachings very well. What did I teach last Sunday? See what I mean? I don't even remember what I taught last Sunday. We have this eraser that goes off and we walk out the doors where the sermons and lectures get erased rather easily. Oh, they feed our souls, but we forget rather quickly. The Lord knows that. Here Moses had been preaching for 30 chapters. Deuteronomy is one gigantic sermon. But the Lord knew that the people wouldn't necessarily remember the sermon, but they wouldn't forget a song. So Moses, you've preached 30 chapters, good for you, but here's the deal. If they're going to remember what they ought to remember, put it to music. Put it in a song. Songs stay in our memories. You hear a song on the radio from 20 years ago, and immediately it brings back memories, and you sing the lyrics as though you heard it yesterday. It's amazing the way that works. In fact, last week, it was kind of interesting that there is a new number one selling album. It's the fastest selling album record project in the history of the world. It sold more copies in its first week of release, 3.6 million copies in 7 days, than any other recording group or artist ever has. It knocked out of the record the group that held it previously, selling 2.4 million copies in the first week, and that's a group called NSYNC. No Strings Attached was the record. And NSYNC got blasted out last week, and I'm kind of glad about that. They should be in the sync as far as I'm concerned, but be that as it may, there was a new album released, and it blew the record away. I mean, it's just amazing, and it's going to be, before this season is over, the top-selling album of all time in all of history, knocking out the Eagles, who presently have that title. And the amazing thing about this album is the group hasn't been together for 30 years. It's a group called, maybe you've heard of them, The Beatles. And the album is called One. It's a compilation of their 27 number one songs put together on a single CD. And man, it is hot. And it's amazing because these songs haven't been sung, you know, on the air regularly for 30 years. And here they are. Why? Because songs stay with us. We don't remember sermons, but we do remember songs. You don't recall what I preached last Sunday, but fill in the blank, would you please? I want to hold your... There you have it. See what I mean? I mean, songs stay with us. That's just the way it is. And the Lord knows that. And so he says to the man Moses that day, hey, you've preached a lot, good for you, but I want you to write a song. And I want you to put it in their ears, and they'll recall that in years to come. When tough times come their way, they'll remember the song. They might not recall the sermon, but they'll remember the song. And so Moses did it that very day. He wrote a song, and it is a hit. It's the first published rock song in history. It's in chapter 32. Chapter 32 is the song, and we'll study it carefully in our Wednesday night study. But notice this, it's the first published rock song. Verse 3 says, I will publish the name of the Lord. And verse 4 says, he is the rock. So there you have it. It's the first published rock song ever. And it is a bestseller, selling millions of copies annually. Wherever the Bible is sold, there it is. This published rock song, this number one hit. This grand song of Moses. Now, I want to take one snippet of this song and talk about it today with you. You see, this song celebrates, among other things, the goodness and greatness of God. And in this song, we hear these words, verse 7. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will show thee, thy elders, and they will tell thee. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he, the Most High, separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Ask your fathers, ask the elders, this verse of that song says, and they will tell you what God did, his sovereign power, how he divided people and placed nations on the planet wherever he wanted to put them. He is sovereign. He does what he pleases. He does what he chooses. And here the song says, ask the older generation, and they'll tell you of the sovereignty and power and grandeur of God, of the Father, who does what he wishes. But here's the thing. The Lord places this people there and those people here. He does so according to his own sovereign plan, dividing people ethnically, placing them geographically, doing what he chooses to do sovereignly. But then he goes on to say, the Lord's portion, verse 9, the Lord's portion is his people. The Lord put people all over the globe, but he took one group of people and said, they are mine. This is my portion. Literally, this is my prize. These people are my prize. I've placed people everywhere on the planet, but these people are my prize. Which people? He goes on to say in verse 9, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Jacob. Jacob, of course, is the name of a man who had 12 sons. And that man's name would be changed later on by God to Israel. Jacob, also known as Israel, had 12 sons. And those 12 sons would become the 12 tribes of Israel. He is, if you would, the father of Israel as far as the tribes go. Abraham had a son named Isaac. Isaac had a son named Jacob. And Jacob had 12 sons who became the 12 tribes of Israel, you see. And God says, that's my inheritance. The people of Israel, that's my inheritance. And it's not just the people of Israel, the people that descend from Jacob, but it's you and me too. You see, Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, Abraham is our father as well in the faith. And Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1, I'll read it to you, you need not turn there. But in Ephesians chapter 1, Paul says, I pray for you, to the Ephesian believers, that you might have wisdom and revelation in the knowledge of him, that the Lord might give you understanding, your eyes being enlightened, so that you may know what the riches of the glory of His inheritance is in the saints. Paul says, I just pray that you might know by the power and revelation of the Spirit that you are His inheritance too. That you are the riches of His glory. That means, very basically, you're His prize. You're His gem. You're His treasure. And as I read that this morning, I was pondering, Lord, how can we really understand that you value us? That we're gems and treasure to you? Paul said, all I can do is pray that God might give you revelation in the inner man, that you'll understand that you are His inheritance. I'm His inheritance. So are you. We're His prize. Now I look at me and I think, man, that's a booby prize. I mean, if I was God, I wouldn't choose me to be His inheritance or to be His prize. If you could make anything or have anything, would you make or choose you to be the inheritance if you were God? I wouldn't choose me. But God did. And this is something which blows my mind, that He looks at me and says, there's my prize, John Corson. That's my inheritance. Oh, I made all the world and I made everything, but the lot of my inheritance, my prize, my portion is John Corson. And you too, who are saints, Christians, children of His, were His treasure, were His gem. How can we understand that? Only by revelation. Revelation of the Spirit and revelation of Jesus Christ. You see, Paul the Apostle said, God proved His love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for me. Now, what Paul declared there in Romans does help me to have a clue about how He values me and values you. Because you know the value of an object by what a person is willing to pay for that object. What was God willing to pay for you? He gave Himself. His body ripped apart. His blood poured out. He hung on the cross like that old poster and bumper sticker. I asked the Lord how much He loves me. And He spread out His arms this much and said, I love you to death. That's so true. How do I know that I am valued by Him? That He views me as something that is valuable, that I am His treasure? Well, I look at the cross of Calvary. See? Now, Paul says, I just pray that you might understand that, that you're His inheritance. And this verse, then, that we're reading here in this Song of Moses, applies not just to Israel, but to spiritual Israel, too. That's me and you, those that are governed by God and children of His. Now, watch this. The text goes on to say, the Lord's portion is His people. Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. That's His prize, His people. He found him, verse 10, in a desert land. Jacob was found, that is, God's people were found in a desert land. When we felt deserted, unloved, uncared for, unimportant, dry, thirsty, going to this watering hole and that well to try and satiate the thirst in our soul, only to find, as Jesus said, whoever drinks of that water will thirst again. And we went there and did that and tried the other and came up dry, empty, in a desert. Like Mick Jagger saying, I can't get no satisfaction. We too found in our generation, in our day, hey, we went here and did that and there's just no way. I'm not satisfied. I'm dry. There's a hole in my soul. The Lord says, that's when I went after you. When you were dry and thirsty, deserted in a desert place, feeling unloved, uncared for, unimportant, I went for you then. And not only in a desert land, but in the waste, howling wilderness. When you were wasted in the waste, howling wilderness. When our lives were being wasted, our time, our talents, our energy, our health, everything, just being wasted in stupidity, howling as a party animal might howl, or howling in pain because of the anguish that we were in. God says, my people, I value them. They're my gems, my treasures, my prize. I found them when they were thirsty and deserted in a desert land, when they were howling in the wasted place of the wilderness. I went after them and I found them. And not only that, he says, after that, finding him, in a desert land, in a waste and howling wilderness, then he led him about. He led him, that is his people, Jacob, Israel, you and me too, for we're his inheritance as well. He led us about. Now the word led there in the Hebrew, if you have a marginal reference, you'll see it means encompassed. That is, when my people were in the desert, wasting away, howling in emptiness, I encompassed them. I threw my arms around them. I enveloped them in myself. I surrounded them with my love. I encompassed them. That's what God said that he does and did to and for his people and me and you as well. This is the song, Moses, that I want these people to know. They're my treasure. I found them in the desert land when they were wasting their lives and howling in pain, and I encompassed them with myself. And then, not only that, he instructed him, verse 10 goes on to say, he instructed him, not just found you and enveloped you, rescued you and saved you, but I instructed you too. Interesting. He instructs us by his word. David declares in Psalm 19 that the law of the Lord, the word of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. His word converts me. I realize by the law that he is good and I'm not. And I need salvation. The law of the Lord is perfect. Yes, converting the soul. The testimonies of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. The word converts the soul. It makes wise the simple. Not the intellectual, not the educated. It makes wise the simple. People like me, like you too. People that are just simple. What we do is we get in the Word and suddenly we have wisdom from above. It's amazing. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimonies of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. He goes on to talk about the commandments of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. Man, I can't tell you the number of times when I have been in the Word when I was somewhat sad or feeling blue. And as I get in the Scripture, something happens. My heart begins to rejoice. And I begin to be set free of my own self and rejoice in the Lord and what he has to say. That's how he instructs us, the word that rejoices the heart, that converts the soul, that makes wise the simple. And that's what God declares here in this song of Moses, inspired by his Spirit. Hey, I found you when you were wiped out. I enveloped you in my love. I lead you in instruction and inspiration. And he goes on to say, last phrase in verse 10, and he kept him as the apple of his eye. He keeps his people, Jacob, Israel, you and me too, for we're his inheritance as well. He keeps us as the apple of his eye. Now, what's the apple of your eye? It's your pupil. And those that study such things, pupilologists or whoever, they tell us something about the pupil, about the eye, being kept as the apple of his eye. The fastest reflex in your body, the quickest reflex in the human anatomy, is the eyelids covering the eyeball when there is danger headed in that direction. If there's a foreign object coming towards your eye, instinctively, intuitively, immediately, your eye closes. How fast? Pupilologists tell us that it closes in 1/1000th of a second. That's how fast that reflex is. It's the fastest reflex in the human body. And what God is declaring is simply this. hey, when something comes your way, when there's danger, I am there to close you in. I'm there to take care of you. I treasure you and protect you as you would treasure and protect your own eyeball, you see. I love this. What a great song. What a grand song. God says, put this song in their ear that they might remember. I'm sovereign. I divided all the nations, but I chose them particularly to be my treasure. And I found them when they were deserted, when they were howling in a wasted condition. And I enveloped them in my love, and I led them with my word, by my word. And I keep them as the pupil, the apple of my eye. And I say, awesome. Maybe though you're sitting here this evening and you might have a little different reaction. Maybe you might say, well, okay. So God rescues us and takes care of us, values us, all those things. Okay, if it's there in the Word, I guess that's probably true. But John, that sounds right. It sounds nice. But it's not the experience that I'm having in light of what I'm going through. You talk about this God who envelops His people, who protects them as the apple of His eye, who leads them and guides them and all the rest. And that sounds all fine and dandy, but hey, John, I'm going through some really tough times, some deep stuff. And I don't sense that protective covering. And I don't understand this enveloping idea. And I'm not being instructed. I don't know which way to go. This might be true, John, theologically, or it might even be true for you personally. But if I'm going to be totally honest with you, Pastor, that's not my situation. Well, I understand that. But that's why you need to read one verse further. Look at verse 11, would you please? After all of that, finding Him and instructing Him, enveloping Him and leading Him and keeping Him, after all of that, it says in verse 11, as an eagle stirs up her nest and flutters over her young and spreads abroad her wings and takes them and bears them on her wings, so the Lord alone did lead Jacob, or His people. And there was no strange God with him. Listen carefully. I love you so much, but I'm not going to allow you to nestle in mediocrity. Huh? The eagle. Hey, they knew about eagles. There in the Middle East, in that region of the world, flies the African eagle, wings that are 10 feet long. A majestic bird. Eagles are on every continent in the world except Antarctica. Eagles are incredible because they soar higher, they fly higher than any other bird. And uniquely, amongst all animals in the animal kingdom, an eagle flying high can look directly into the sun and not burn out his eye. Why? Because he has built-in Oakleys. When he looks at the sun, these little eye shades come flipping down. It's true. They cover his eye. He can still see through them. They're essentially a sunglass, if you would, sunglasses. And consequently, they kick in when he looks toward the sun, and so he can stare at the sun indefinitely and not burn out his eyes or be blinded, you see. Eagles. Birds that are powerful. In fact, nations adopt the eagle as their national symbol, as we have in this country, the American eagle, the bald eagle. as Russia has in Tsarist days. The eagle was on their flag, on their coinage, and the eagle is back again in the Duma, in their house, their parliament, and back on their coins once more. The eagle. The Roman Empire, the eagle was their symbol. The Assyrians, the eagle. Why? The eagle is an amazing creature, strong and powerful. The African eagle flies 100 miles per hour with her massive wings. And these eagles do something. They're powerful. They're impressive. They soar high. And they also are, I guess, romantic. They mate for life. They choose one partner and stay with that partner all of their days. And once a year, the wife, the lady eagle, she lays 2 eggs. Now, these 2 eggs are in the eagle's nest that's always high, usually over some bluff or some ravine or some canyon, inaccessible to potential predators or problems. The nest is built and the mother puts her eggs therein, lays her eggs therein. 2 eggs, generally, per female eagle annually. The problem is the first egg hatches, and generally when the second egg hatches, the older brother will pick on the younger brother and usually pick him apart to death. Kind of sad, but that's the way it is. If you're a younger brother, you understand that, how that works. So you generally have then 1 eagle surviving. 2 hatched, 1 dies, the other thrives. And what happens is, for the next 6 weeks, that eagle, that eaglet, we'll call our eaglet Ernie. Ernie Eaglet. He's there in the nest. He's got it made in the shade. I mean, he can see lots of things from that vantage point in his nest overlooking the canyon or the ravine. And there he is, being fed once an hour by his mama, winging her way and giving him food hour after hour. And he gets bigger and fatter and chubbier and plumper. And by week number 5, he has now grown quite large. And then something begins to happen to him. See, mom and dad designed the nest in such a way that these massive sticks which make up the nest actually are pointing inward. And so as he gets fatter, as he gets plumper, something begins to happen. He begins to find himself being poked by these sticks that were embedded in the nest, actually for that purpose. Now he's thinking, Ernie Eaglet, why couldn't my mom and dad make a more comfortable nest than this? This is irritating. This is agitating. This is provoking and uncomfortable. What's the deal? Why couldn't my bird brains, why couldn't they design something a little better than this? But it was all part of the intention. For you see, preparation is happening in week 5 and week 6 to get Ernie to do something which he otherwise would never want to do, and that is to fly. See? So now he's big and he's getting poked and he's getting uncomfortable, and he might blame his mom or blame his dad or blame the government or whatever it might be. But in reality, it's all part of the plan. That can happen to you. That can happen to me. We're comfy. We're cozy. We're chubby. And all of a sudden, something begins to happen that agitates me, that pokes at you. And we say, hey, this isn't right. This shouldn't be happening. My boss shouldn't treat me this way. Or my friend shouldn't poke me that way. This isn't right what's going on. But wait a minute. It's all part of a divine design, a grand plan. And wise is the woman, wise is the man who will not blame the sticks, but realize it's part of the plan of the Maker, the Creator, God the Father. See? He's agitated. He's bugged. He's pierced. He's hurting a bit. But it's all part of the plan. And then, here comes mom, flying her way with her 10-foot wings, powerfully headed in the direction of little Ernie Eaglet. Oh boy, another meal. But there's nothing in her mouth. And he wonders, did she foot the bill? What's going on here? Why isn't it? I don't understand what's going on. There's no food. And he sees Ernie in her mother's eye, something which he hasn't seen before. And she takes her massive wing, and like our text in verse 11 says, she stirs the nest. She bumps it. And Ernie gets thrown out. And man, he can't believe that. What a clumsy mother I have. And he is so upset as he begins to fall hundreds of feet to the ravine below. And he's squawking away and he's batting his wings and feathers are flying and down is flying and all the rest. And he's angry, he's upset. He's squeaking, he's squawking, he's crying. Maybe he's swearing if he's not a Christian. And he's just really upset. How could this be? What's going on? And all of a sudden, as he falls, the ground is getting closer and the rocks are getting bigger. And he says, oh no, it's over. This is it. And he's about ready to crash when, just as our text says, Mama swoops down and bears her young on her wings. She literally swoops underneath Ernie right before he crashes. And she then allows him to sit on her back. He puts his talons in her back, hanging on for dear life, as now she takes him back up and puts the nest aright and puts him back in again. Whew, that was close, Ernie says. Man, I hope Mom learned a lesson about being clumsy. I hope Mom realizes this is serious stuff and she better get her act together. And it seems that Mom learned a lesson, at least from Ernie's perspective, for a couple of days anyway, until, 3 days later or so, Mom makes her way again with no food in her beak, no food in her bill. And Ernie goes, oh no, what's the deal? And boom, she takes her wing and she stirs the nest, just like verse 11 says. And once again, Ernie is turned out and he's fallen down and he's flapping and he's filleting away. He's screeching, he's screaming, he's crying. Oh no, as he falls, and the ground is coming up and the rocks are getting large, and he feels like, this is it, I can't go on, I'm not going to make it. When all of a sudden, Mama swoops in, and Ernie once again lands on her back and hangs on with his talons for dear life as she takes him once more and straightens out the nest and puts Ernie back in again. Amazing. Ernie's going, man, my mom is a klutz. I better call CDC right away. I got to get a lawyer. Something's not right here. And then 3 days later, guess what? Mama comes once more in the direction of Ernie in his little nest where he's poked and he's not very comfortable, but man, it beats being beaten on the rocks below. But wait, she knocks him over a third time. And the same process continues on a fourth time, a fifth time, a sixth time, usually a seventh and an eighth and a ninth time. Somewhere between the sixth and ninth time, when the nest is stirred, like our text says, in one of those instances, on one of those occasions, as he's screaming and afraid and upset and ticked off and can't understand, and he catches air. Whoa. And all of a sudden, he's flying. He had no idea that he could. He's no longer sore at his mother. He's soaring with his mother. He's right there. And he's flapping away and he's flying around and he can't believe it. He didn't have any idea that that was even a possibility. He admired his mom and his dad, but he never thought that could be in him. No, not really. Until he was made uncomfortable, until he was kicked out of the nest, until he was tossed down and thinking that there was no way that he would recover that day. But soon, he's soaring. See, the intent of Mom, the intent of Dad, was not to make him soar, but to make him soar. See? What are you doing, God? You tell us in this text that I'm your treasure, that you keep me as the apple of your eye, that you lead me, that you encompass me, that you found me in the wasted desert place, and you value me to a huge degree. I'm your inheritance. Well, then tell me, Lord, why? Why am I headed for the rocks? The marriage is on the rocks. The business is on the rocks. The finances are on. This is a rocky time. I'm going to die. Where are you? How come? What's going on? Whew. And right before you crash, it might be only a moment before you hit the rock. It might be only a moment before you're dashed to death. But before it happens, boom, he swoops in. And he bears you and he bears me on his back. And we go up to the nest again. Whew, that was close. Okay, Lord, we got through that one, but I hope you've learned your lesson about being clumsy with me. And 3 days or 4 days later, you know the story. You know the scenario. He comes back in your direction, and once again, as the text says, he stirs the nest, and out you go, squawking away. Listen, God loves me and you too much for you to settle into the comfortability of mediocrity. So he makes your nest uncomfortable, first of all. You get poked. Ouch. Agitated. You're irritated. God's saying, getting you ready. Getting you ready to do something new. Okay, great. Boom. Whoa! What's this? I wasn't asking for that. I thought a new nest with cushiony sides. I thought you would remove the sticks. You're tipping me out. I'm falling down. What's the big idea? I'm going to teach you to fly, son. And it might take 5, 6, 8, 10, 15 times. But I'm not going to let you settle for mediocrity when you could soar in the heavenlies. I know. You do too. We all have stories to tell. I was in my early 20s. And I went to San Jose, California, where I grew up. And my brother Dave, who's older than me, we decided to start a church there. Felt led of the Lord to do that. And as I've shared before, my brother Dave was, a Vietnam vet, a Marine sergeant, decorated and all that stuff. And he was a real straight arrow kind of guy. And he would relate to people like at IBM, at Hewlett Packard, the Silicon Valley people in San Jose before it was known as Silicon Valley. But the big technological companies were there, right where we were at. And so at that time, he was a suit and tie kind of guy, a Vietnam sergeant, Marine guy and all the rest. And me, I was just kind of coming in off the beach and I kind of had real scraggly hair and blue Levi's and flip-flops like I still wear. And so we thought, this is going to be great. We'll start this church and Dave, you'll relate to all the classy guys and the intelligentsia and I'll relate to the losers like me. And we'll reach everybody that way. That was our plan. That was our heart. And you know what? It worked. As we started out, the church grew immediately. And we had hundreds of people within the first few weeks. It was an amazing thing for us to see. And God was working and things were happening. And it was a wonderful experience. But then, about at month 3 or 4, I began to be poked. And I began to get very uncomfortable and irritated. It wasn't anybody or anything. It was just the situation, the nest that I was in. And I would go home and talk to my wife and I would squawk and I would say, this isn't fair or that's not right or how come or what have you. And I was being poked. I didn't know why. And the nest got overturned and it didn't make sense to me. And I wondered, Lord, what do you want me to do? Lord, what do you... Now listen carefully. Because when you're being poked and when the nest is being stirred, the tendency is to say, okay. Well, I'm falling, Lord. Lord, things are happening that are dangerous and ominous and difficult. Lord, do you want me to do this or do you want me to do that? But we got to do something because I'm headed for the rocks. Moses knows about that. The people were murmuring, we're tired of this manna. We want meat to eat. And they were going to stone Moses because they expected Moses to take care of them. And they were sick and tired of the manna that came their way every single day. And Moses cried out to the Lord, Lord, the people are going to stone me. Well, feed them, Moses. Feed them meat. Well, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to kill all the cattle that we're supposed to take into the promised land to start our herds with? That's important that we have those cattle. Do you want me to slaughter them here for a big barbecue today and not have cattle to bring into the land of promise ultimately? Or do you want me to go to the Red Sea, back towards Egypt, Is that what you want me to do? To go back towards Egypt and fish out of the Red Sea? That doesn't seem to be practical or logical. Which one, Lord? Do you want the cattle killed? That doesn't make sense. Do you want us to go back to the Red Sea? That seems a bit fishy to me. What do you want, Lord? What do you want? Surf or turf? What do I do here? You know the story. What do you want me to do? I'm falling. The people are mad. I'm headed for the rocks, literally. They're going to stone me. What do you want me to do? A or B? Number one or number two? You know the story. God didn't answer Moses. Come on, Lord. I'm headed for the rocks. We got to do something here. No answer. It was strangely, ominously quiet. I know how that sounds. Maybe you do too. When suddenly, Moses looked up, and there on the horizon, coming in his direction, gazillions of quail were flapping in his direction. It wasn't surf or turf, it's fowl. And here they come, millions of birds. And they came in right here, right about 3.5 feet high or so, because it says the men took their sticks, and it says they began to bat and to beat those birds. And it says that every man among them had a homer. I like that. They all had a homer. You know, a homer is a bushel. And everyone had a homer, the Bible says. The King James tells us, man, nobody fouled out. I mean, they were really connecting. Some had doubles, actually. It was a grand slam breakfast, believe you me. I mean, the birds, they were coming in. From where? From out of the blue. Oh, here I thought it was option one or option two. I thought it was this or that. And look what's happened, Lord. You were quiet because you had an option that I never would have in my wildest dreams come up with. Quail by the gazillions flying in from the blue, from heaven. Lord, what do you want me to do? I said, the nest is being overturned. I'm being agitated. Do you want this or do you want that? I gave the Lord two choices. Didn't hear much until, a few months later, a telephone call came from out of the blue from Applegate, Oregon. Hey, John, yeah? You don't know us, but we've been listening to some of your tapes from down there, and we're really interested in what you're teaching. Would you come up here and do a retreat for us? Sure, might as well. I'm free-falling anyway. So I came up, taught the folks, and came back again and felt, oh, Lord, this is what you had in mind. I didn't have a clue. It didn't make sense to me, Lord, the poking and the stirring of the nest. And I thought that I was, as I was squawking, but Lord, you knew all the time. You wanted me to go where I had no idea I could go and do what I had no idea I could do. And how did you do it, Lord? By making me uncomfortable in my present nest and turning over the nest where I'm flapping and crying and screeching and complaining. But wait, Lord, I never did crash. You always caught me just like you said you would do. And ultimately, in due season, I get it. I'm flying. I'm soaring. It wasn't this or that. It was something other than. It was something greater than. It was something grander than I could have possibly imagined. Awesome. Awesome. Maybe you're free falling right now. And maybe you've been squawking a bit. Know this. You're not going to hit bottom. You might get real close. But the Lord is going to bear you on his wings and take you back up to the nest again to catch your breath for a day or two. And then you'll get knocked around once more, but for a reason, to teach you how to fly, how to soar. Well, John, what should I do then? If it's true that I'm his treasure, if it's true that he cares passionately about me and won't let me settle into the nest of mediocrity, if it's true that he's going to turn over, stir up the nest, and then rescue me at the last moment, and then set me back therein and repeat the process over again until I fly where I've never been before and do what I had no idea I could do. I've been there. And don't worry, I won't, but I could spend hours talking about stories with you in my own life about nests being overturned and feeling as though you're falling and wondering, what are you doing, Lord? Where are you, Father? Only to find over and over and over that he is faithful and brings us up until we finally begin to fly in new dimensions to new heights and elevations. All of us could share stories like that, no doubt. But this is what God wanted his people to remember. You're my treasure, but I love you too much to let you settle and nestle in mediocrity. I'm going to overturn your nest occasionally, and you're going to squawk a lot. But the ultimate goal is to get you to soar and to fly where you've never, ever been before. Well, John, so what do I do? Okay, so he's going to tip over my nest. Is there anything I can do to speed up the process? Listen carefully. I'm almost done. Listen carefully. How can you learn to fly more quickly? How can you speed up the process to a much greater degree? They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. What? Wait on the Lord. But I'm headed for the rocks. I got to do it. Stop. But you don't understand. I'm going, stop. But I'm going to be wiped out. Stop. But you don't realize the seriousness and the sadness and the pain and the problems. Stop. They that wait on the Lord will mount up with wings as eagles. Waiting on the Lord does not mean that you just passively do nothing. Waiting on the Lord means, well, like what a waiter does when you're at a nice restaurant. How can I help you, madam? What can I bring to you, sir? Can I get you some coffee? How about some dessert? That's what it means to wait on the Lord. Father, enough about me and my squawking and my nest problems. I'm here to serve and wait on you. I'm here, Lord, to give you the platter of praise. I'm here, Lord, to make this a wonderful time for you instead of always squawking about me. I'm going to go to Friday night this week. I was here at Friday night a couple nights ago. I tell you, talk about waiting on the Lord. Just praising him and saying, Lord, we're here to serve you. It's a grand, great opportunity. No agenda except to say, we're here, Lord, to wait on you and to honor you, to pleasure you. Man, it's the thing to do. Wait on the Lord. Reestablish your morning devotional time. And say, you know, Lord, I don't understand why I'm being poked right now and why the nest is being turned over a bit. And I feel like I'm flopping around. But here I am today, Lord, to wait on you. They that wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. Mount up with wings. They'll run and they'll not be weary. You'll run the race. They'll walk and and they'll not stumble. You'll walk in stability. That's what I've got to remember. That's what I've got to do. To not panic. Is it number one or number two? The birds are coming. They're on the way. I never would have thought of it. But that's what the Lord intended all the time. From out of the blue comes blessings for me, blessings for you. Wait on the Lord. He's teaching you how to fly. He's taking you to a new dimension. I guarantee that if you wait on Him, you'll be soaring a whole lot quicker than if we just keep on squawking. The key is to wait on Him. Last comment, verse 11 ends with this phrase, "So there was no strange God with him." See, his nest was overturned. Squawking, wondering, questioning, and all the rest. But as he began to soar, he began to fly. It's funny, when you're soaring in the heavenlies, because he taught you and forced you to do so, the other gods, the things of this world, grow strangely dim. And like the eagle, you look at the sun, and you can't take your eyes off the sun. And you find yourself enamored with him and focused on him. And man, like the eagle in the sky, you and I are the ones that fix our eyes upon the Son, Jesus Christ. And when that happens, the things of the world grow strangely dim. See, our verse in verse 11 says, there was no strange God with him. He lost his interest in those things. They were no longer attractive to him. And that's what the Lord will do for you and for me too, when he teaches us to soar higher and fly in new dimensions. There'll be no strange God among us either. We'll be free. You watch, you wait, you'll see.